The following is for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
After Crimea, will a new Cold War of sanctions and counter-sanctions, treaties, and troop moves mean more or less stability for Ukraine, Russia, and the West?
Unsound on the ground, a record $1.2 billion fine for the Toyota gas pedal cover-up, and growing investigation of GM's delayed ignition recall.
Deportation, limitation, limitations. Does the president have more authority than he admits to deport fewer of the undocumented?
Wheels of a Dream, what a journalist who writes about death learns about life, his own and America's, by cycling cross-country.
Lauding Lavin, the award-winning stage, screen, and TV actress Linda Lavin is getting a Lifetime Achievement Award for her singing from the folks in Cabaret.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For your ears only, for the week of March 23rd, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. Sometimes an erratic flight path is heroism, not terrorism. That was Mary Schiavo, former U.S. Transportation Department Inspector General, on the missing Malaysian jetliner whose autopilot was reset before it lost contact, perhaps towards a nearby landing strip because of an in-flight emergency, or further to the vast and deep Indian Ocean to prevent a devastating crash into populated areas. Several satellite sightings led to extensive searching over those waters off Australia's coast. Now this.
We had a referendum which took place in the Crimea, fully consistent with all norms of international law. More than 82% of voters took place, and more than 96% of those who voted for reunification with Russia.
We are imposing sanctions on specific individuals responsible for undermining the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and government of Ukraine.
There are now travel bans and asset freezes, and if Russia takes further action to destabilize the Ukraine and to threaten its territorial integrity, there will be further consequences.
In the days that followed those remarks by Russian President Vladimir Putin, U.S. President Barack Obama, and British Prime Minister David Cameron, the world moved nervously closer to Cold War-style confrontation. Putin signed legislation to make Crimea part of his country again and launched military exercises on the border with Ukraine. Obama escalated sanctions against key figures in Putin's inner circle and sent some military units to NATO nations. And the European Union formalized closer economic ties with Kiev, essentially the step that alienated Crimea's Russian majority in the first place.
To consider the factors that led up to the new East-West standoff and what may come next, for your ears only, we're joined by Tara Sonnenschein, former Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs, who visited Ukraine just last year. She's currently a Distinguished Fellow in the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
U.S. sanctions against Putin insiders seem somehow small bore versus the major national and international interests at stake. But are those individuals really key to the way the regime in Moscow functions, with real influence on what Putin does next?
Well, let's first step back and remember that Putin took Crimea, and I think we can now say took Crimea, with military might and propaganda. The West is responding with economic pressure, and I do think this second round of U.S. sanctions will bite. We're talking about freezing assets and slapping travel bans on real Putin insiders, including his personal banker, Yuri Kovalchuk. And we've hit Bank Rossiya, which I do think is going to lead to Russian stocks suffering. You see Visa and MasterCard already ending services to those who bank with Bank Rossiya. So I do think this is the beginning of an economic fortress that may really pinch.
Is Ukraine in a way more stable without the strong pro-Russian population of Crimea challenging Ukrainian interests, culture, values?
Well, it's a good question, because I think when you start cutting off the Russian limbs of a country, if you will, you start sowing internal division. And frankly, you make other ethnic Russians in other parts of the former Soviet Union very anxious. You've got Russian populations in Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Moldova.
How do you compare the U.S. sanctions with those enacted by the EU?
The EU sanctions certainly mirror U.S. sanctions, but are, I would say, a bit less imposing, only because you've got so many nations that have come to agreement when you're talking about EU sanctions. But I think if the EU and the U.S. are serious about enacting all these sanctions, it could have an effect long-term, similar to what we've seen happen in Iran, where the nation really suffered from sanctions and is now practically begging for inclusion in the West.
How do the sums of financial aid and loan guarantees from the EU and Washington compare with Ukraine's actual needs?
Ukraine is really suffering, and one does worry about whether the loan guarantees and the IMF package will be fast enough in effecting change. $1 billion of loan guarantees from the U.S. sounds like a lot, but remember that Ukraine has been struggling under the weight of this Russian intervention for a long time, and you've seen lavish palaces and other spending issues that makes me concerned that there's been a lot of money siphoned off from Ukraine, and that puts it behind the eight ball from the beginning. Having been there, the educational system needs a lot of strengthening, and Ukraine needs investments in rule of law, democratic institutions, independent media, and its gas shale resources, which maybe this is an opportunity to help them exploit.
Talk about the key role ahead you see for German Chancellor Angela Merkel and the strain in Washington-Berlin relations because of NSA communication surveillance.
Well, Germany clearly has a pivotal role to play if you just look at the map and geographically vis-a-vis Ukraine and its whole NATO relationship. The U.S.-German relationship has been strained by the disclosures from Snowden, but as much as these things create short-term frictions and tensions, I think long-term we are going to want to work very closely with Merkel. She's been playing the role of go-between, if you will, with Putin, sort of the good cop, bad cop. On a given day, she's on the phone trying to persuade him to come down off this limb, and other times threatening. She's also been one of the first to mention that Putin seems not really totally clear and of this universe at times in the way he's approaching things. So I think she's an honest broker, and I think that relationship's going to be important.
Another test of international relations last week was response to the missing Malaysian jetliner, and you noted that such crises in the air, sea, and space often bring out unusual cooperation. But don't we seem to see nations withholding and delaying information that shows their radar, satellite, and other intelligence capabilities in the Malaysian air case?
Boy, it has been a real rocky road, literally a roller coaster for the families and for all of us watching and for the governments in their disclosure and dissemination. Although for all the uneven dissemination in the last day or so, you've seen literally the Malaysian authorities reading a note about Chinese satellites, literally being handed a piece of paper during a briefing. So this has been literally and figuratively all over the map. My point in my writings has been that a crisis in the air like this or in the ocean creates strange bedfellows. These events remind us that particularly when you're not on land with borders and passports and visas and armies and troops, you are forced to work with nations that you argue about on many topics because you simply have no choice.
Tara Sonenshein is a former Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs, currently a distinguished fellow in the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University.
Quote from the news, "You are being too pessimistic." That was Osama bin Laden after 9/11 when his son-in-law, Sulaiman Abu Ghaith, warned that the U.S. would eventually kill him and topple the Taliban in Afghanistan. Ghaith testified about it at his New York trial on charges of complicity with the plot.
Next, not safe and sound on the ground. Toyota and GM, for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Twitterm witter, we will wipe out roots of all. That was Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan in a campaign speech as the government tried to block Twitter for circulating recordings of phone calls and leaked documents that implicated top officials and their relatives in a widespread corruption investigation. Ironically, last week was also Twitter's 8th anniversary. Now this.
Toyota confronted a public safety emergency as if it were simply a public relations problem. The $1.2 billion payment represents the largest criminal penalty imposed on a car company in the history of the United States.
Scrutiny of the recall has expanded beyond the review by the federal regulators at NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. As of now, two congressional committees have announced that they will examine the issue. And it's been reported that the Department of Justice is looking into this matter.
As the world hung on every speck of speculation about the missing Malaysian jetliner and the fears it raised about accidental and man-made challenges to safety in the air, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder reminded us of safety threats closer to home and to the ground. His announcement of a record criminal penalty against Toyota for covering up fatal flaws in gas pedal operation going back 4 years also sent a chill through domestic rival General Motors as it faces scrutiny over a long-delayed recall of many older models. Their faulty ignition system has been linked with at least a dozen fatalities and perhaps more than 300, as explained by Mary Barra, GM's first female CEO.
Back at the start of the Toyota episode, we spoke about it with Clarence Ditlow, executive director of the Center for Auto Safety, founded by Consumers Union and Ralph Nader in 1970. And for Your Ears Only, he's on the line again now to appraise what's happened since in the field of auto safety and automaker responsibility. Welcome back to the program.
No, thank you.
You called the $1.2 billion settlement with Toyota a game changer, though no executives may go to jail, and the sum is just a fraction of company profits, even cash on hand. What overall impact do you see?
This is going to have a big impact, because up until now, it paid the auto companies to conceal defects to avoid safety recalls that could cost more than the penalty. And now, all of a sudden, the maximum penalty has gone from $17 million during the Toyota days to $1.2 billion when the Department of Justice steps in.
Talk more about the threat to Toyota contained in what's called a deferred prosecution agreement.
Well, what is hidden behind this agreement is that there were criminal penalties brought against Toyota. And the deferred prosecution means that if you, Toyota, don't live up to the strict agreement of our settlement, and if you even begin to deviate from safety procedures and hide defects again, then we're going to reinstate the criminal prosecution and see if we can get criminal penalties assessed before a jury.
Toyota paid more than $17 million in civil fines over the problem with gas pedals getting hung up on floor mats below them. Does last week's criminal settlement become a significant factor in new death and disability claims by individuals?
Well, in terms of their individual lawsuits, no. But what it will mean is we'll have fewer lawsuits in the future, as we'll have fewer defective vehicles on the road to kill and injure consumers.
In the Toyota case, court papers remind us the company actually canceled a corrective action to hide the fact that it was aware of the gas pedal problem while blaming driver error for accidental acceleration. Have such corporate cover-ups been usual in the car business, calculating the cost to correct versus possible penalties and image damage?
Well, unfortunately, they are all too commonplace, because what we see is settled lawsuit after settled lawsuit where there's a confidentiality agreement. You can't talk about it as part of the settlement. And what that means is the government doesn't find out about it, Center for Auto Safety doesn't find out about it, and the public doesn't benefit by getting a recall.
To what degree do you see similarities between Toyota's actions and inactions and the long delay by General Motors in responding to complaints and accidents involving keys slipping out of the ignition switch, cutting off power steering, power brakes, and airbags?
They're very similar. There's two differences. Number one, the so-called crash recorder on the Cobalts and Ions, they actually recorded the fact that the ignition was turned off and in the accessory mode. And in Toyota, the crash reporters were unclear as to what was causing the sudden acceleration. But more importantly, in the GM case, because of the bankruptcy in 2009, it wiped out all lawsuits on crashes that occurred before that. And these are crashes and defects that General Motors had covered up. So now that bankruptcy provision may very well be lifted and allow consumers who were victims of these concealed defects by GM to sue and recover compensation.
Do you see greater leniency on the part of the government for the new GM because the ignition problem and the long delay in responding came before the record bankruptcy and under previous leadership?
Well, we would hope that wouldn't be a factor. And it's now clear that whatever went on under the previous administration, this new administration has been stung by this cover-up, and they are going after GM hammer and tongs.
Both the Toyota and GM cases involve older models. What are your concerns about the predicted onset of new computer-driven vehicles, so-called smart cars, that minimize the chance for driver error that's the fault in so many, if not most, auto accidents? More safe overall or not?
Now, we're very concerned about the new electronic systems in cars, particularly as we go to driverless, because we haven't set safety standards that will regulate the new electronic controls. For example, we don't have any kind of standard that says you have to test the computer software to make sure there aren't any bugs in it. And the last thing that we want is one of these smart cars having a bug in it and becoming another crash.
Do you think drivers will become less responsible the way so many of us remember less of what our smartphones and tablets now carry around for us?
Well, that's a big concern. And most of the smart car systems that are being put in today also have wake-up alarms that sound at the same time they're beginning to take control to tell you, put your attention back on the driving and put your smartphone away.
Will that make drivers less responsible legally as well when accidents do happen?
No. The driver is still, if there's a crash, I mean, if there's a crash right now, you still separate the liability between was there a defect in the vehicle that caused the crash? If so, the manufacturer is responsible. If there wasn't a defect, then you hold the driver responsible for any flaws in their driving. And in the future, the same rule will apply. If there's a flaw in the computer that caused the crash, the manufacturer is liable. If it's the driver who made the mistake, the driver's liable.
Thank you. Clarence Ditlow is Executive Director of the Center for Auto Safety.
Quote from the news, "We feel frightened by the plant, but we also know we need it." That was Akihito Sakamoto, an Ikata, Japan town employee, reflecting the reluctant trend of Japanese communities toward approving revival of the nation's nuclear power network offline since the Fukushima disaster 3 years ago. And this, they've essentially simulated a terrible coal ash spill by pumping the pond out. That was Peter Harrison, a lawyer for the Waterkeeper Alliance, after North Carolina state regulators reported that Duke Energy illegally pumped up to 61 million gallons of coal ash wastewater into a local river just 6 weeks after its more massive coal ash spill into another river.
Next, the limitation on limitation of deportation under Obama for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelworth with this quote from the news. The end of employer-sponsored insurance. That was the prediction of Zeke Emanuel, a key designer of Obamacare, on the direction that government-mandated private insurance is leading the country. It comes with his new book titled Reinventing American Healthcare, How the Affordable Care Act Will Improve Our Terribly Complex, Blatantly Unjust, Outrageously Expensive, Grossly Inefficient, Error-Prone System. Now this.
What the president has asked Secretary Johnson to do is conduct a review of practices to ensure that within the confines of the law, we are carrying out these policies in the most humane way possible, because he is very cognizant of the pain that families who are separated have been feeling as a result of deportations. But there is no fix here that does not include legislation.
Under escalating pressure from immigrant rights advocates, President Obama last week pledged to review policies that have driven deportation of the undocumented towards 2 million at a record pace since he took office. It was the first suggestion in over a year that Obama might act alone on immigration while legislative reform languishes in the House of Representatives. Indeed, the House Republican majority recently passed legislation allowing a lawsuit against the president over deferred deportation of young dreamers brought here illegally as children that Obama had previously ordered.
Beyond that two-year delay, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney continued to insist the president cannot legally order a more general deportation slowdown, which Obama has called tantamount to refusing to enforce the law, and for which view Hispanic activists have dubbed him deporter-in-chief. But many legal experts dismiss that not-in-my-power position, according to an article in the latest issue of the New Republic magazine. And for your ears only, the author of that article joins us now. She's staff writer Nora Kaplan-Bricker. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
What was the rationale and legal basis for the Obama-backed delay in Dreamer deportations, and who exactly is covered?
So the rationale is that the president has something called prosecutorial discretion. This is based in our government's fundamental separation of powers. Essentially, Congress makes the laws, and the president can decide how those laws are enforced, in particular, enforced against individuals. So deferred action for dreamers or for childhood arrivals, better known as dreamers, essentially just formalizes a priority that the president had already put in place through this prosecutorial discretion, saying, you know, people who have known no other home other than this country, have lived here their whole lives, gone to school here, they're very low priority for deportation. They're pretty much the bottom of the list. We should be deporting, you know, criminals, people who just arrived at the border long before we would deport dreamers. And so he formalized that very rational priority with deferred action for childhood arrivals, better known as DACA, in 2012. And this deferred action covers essentially people who came to the U.S. before they were 16. There are a few other limits in there. They had to be under the age of 31 when DACA was enacted. They have to have lived in the U.S. continuously since 2007, can't have committed a crime. They must be in school or working. But it essentially covers these people who have lived in the U.S. since they were children and came here with their parents, did not come here of their own accord.
On what legal grounds does the White House argue it cannot further expand the definition of the undocumented whose deportations can be delayed? And what do the legal experts say about that White House reasoning?
So the interesting thing here is that the White House hasn't exactly made the argument in specific legal terms. What they've done is more a sort of more political talking point. Many of the activist groups campaigning for immigrant rights have said, stop deportations. You know, the common slogan is not one more deportation. And what the White House has said is that we can't do that. That's illegal. We have to enforce the law. The law says, you know, we have to deport people who are here illegally. So, you know, a heckler in San Francisco in November yelled at the president to stop deportations, and he said, actually, I can't do that. And to some extent, that argument is true. They can't just stop enforcing the law. They can't just stop deporting people altogether. But what the legal experts point out is that framing the argument that way in some ways is disingenuous. It really skates over this very broad legal ground between stopping deportations altogether and DACA, which is sort of all we have in place. There's a lot of range in there where the White House does have a great deal of discretion.
And what might those categories be?
Parents of dreamers, people who have family members in the United States, veterans who have served in the military here, people whose work is contributing to the economy here. You know, even some of those categories are pretty narrow and don't get at what I think the advocacy community would like to see, which is, you know, more or less anybody that the administration doesn't have a strong argument for deporting, like, criminals, crime lords, drug lords, would be allowed to stay.
The experts say Obama would run into political barriers before legal ones if he broadened the delay in deportations, beginning with congressional power of the purse. Explain that.
So Congress does appropriate a certain amount of money every year for deportations, and that's sort of the most concrete limit on what Obama can do here legally is that he does have to spend that money for the purposes that it's been appropriated for. But a number of experts have pointed out that, you know, some of these kind of high-priority deportations are very expensive. It's very expensive to track down a drug lord or somebody with a huge network. But that's also a great use of those funds. That's the kind of person who the Department of Homeland Security should be prioritizing deporting. On the other hand, it's less expensive to just sort of do a workplace raid and deport hundreds of people who, yes, they're here illegally, but they're employed, they're, you know, working in this factory. So you could certainly slow the rate of deportations and slow the deportation of low-priority people by kind of pushing more of that appropriated money toward these high-priority deportations.
Nora Kaplan-Bricker is a staff writer at the New Republic magazine.
Quote from the news, a plausible pathway to explain why some people are more vulnerable. That was Li Heitzai of MIT's Institute for Learning and Memory on a series of Harvard studies suggesting that Alzheimer's is related to a failure in the brain's stress response system and levels of a protein called REST that could protect people against the disease.
Next, on the Wheels of a Dream, bicycle wheels for your ears only.
We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. A travesty getting sent to the principal's office. That was Jamie Barnett, lawyer for the female army captain who filed charges of sexual assault against her boss in Afghanistan, Brigadier General Jeffrey Sinclair, after a military judge simply reprimanded him, ordered a $20,000 fine, and permitted him to retire with pension and other benefits. Sinclair previously pleaded guilty to lesser charges, including adultery with the captain and others. Now this.
Well, when he is old enough, I will show him America, and he will ride on the wheels of a dream.
From Ragtime. Bruce Weber's dream was to wheel across America, to wheel across America, and now he's done it twice on leg power only to learn how the country and he himself had changed in the years between. An obituary writer for the New York Times, Weber sent dispatches back to the Times in 2011, chronicling his adventures on a 95-day, 4,000-mile bicycle journey from Astoria, Oregon, to New York's George Washington Bridge. And they formed the basis of his new book, Life is a Wheel. Love, Death, Etc., and a Bike Ride Across America from Scribner's.
During that ride, or just after, Weber turned 58 and reflected both on his first cross-country cycle trip in 1993 at age 39 and another through Vietnam 2 years later. He describes the landscapes and communities he passes through as well as his exhaustion, mental and physical, simply getting through the next mile at some points. And to talk about it all for your ears only, Bruce Weber joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Let's start with your first solo cross-country cycle in 1993. What prompted it?
Well, I was 39 years old, and I guess I envisioned it as a salute to my vanishing youth. It was I'd done a few bicycle trips, much shorter on my own, and I thought, well, this will be a challenge. And I probably won't get a chance to do anything like it again, and I probably won't be fit enough to do anything like it again.
What led you to do it again?
My life needed a jump start a little bit. I was working as an obituary writer, which meant that the subject of death was on my mind quite a lot. I felt the years creeping up on me. Time was ticking along, and I thought, I had a great time on that trip, and it really was one of the highlights of my life. I'd like to let's see if I can regenerate some of that enthusiasm. But the other thing was that really was happening was that I wanted to write a book, and I had long thought that a solitary bike journey across the United States is a reasonable metaphor for the long sort of solitary journey that everyone is on, and that I could write. And since I had done it before, that I could write about myself as an American man over the last 50 years.
What place in that journey stands out most in your memory, and why?
Well, I would say the place that stands out is Logan Pass, which is at the top of Going to the Sun Road in Glacier Park in Montana. And the reason that it stands out is that it was was literally the high point of the trip. And it was the middle of it was at the top of the stiffest climb of the trip and the most sort of exhilarating and rewarding challenge of the trip. I mean, by the time I got to the top, I was, both exhausted and feeling so proud of myself. And if you've ever been up there, if you've ever been to Glacier Park, it's just absolutely spectacular. And the reward of having put forth all that effort was... I compared it in the book to being kissed by my 17-year-old girlfriend.
And what was the biggest change you noticed in the country and in yourself over the 18 years in between?
Well, I think that the differences in the country are much more noticeable when you're not on a bicycle. I think it's pretty clear. We are a much more polarized country ideologically now than we were in 1993. And I think that we get our personal relations through electronic media now. And I don't think that helps any. But on a bicycle trip across the U.S., I didn't run into any of that. I'm a New Yorker. I come from a very blue area of the country, and I was riding a bike through some very red places in the country, and running into a lot of people who probably disagree with me about a lot of things. But there was none of that on this trip.
Well, they certainly respected what you were doing. I'm thinking Vietnam, which you also cycled through, has probably changed even more than America in 18 years. Any plans to make that trip again?
Well, I'd love to go back to Vietnam again. When I was there, it was just as America was normalizing relations with the Vietnamese, and they were both very welcoming and very curious, and they were just developing a service economy, so they were trying to figure out how to be how to run hotels and restaurants. It was pretty great. It was pretty great.
You were inspired by Hemingway and Samuel Beckett. How so?
I quoted both of them in the book. They both wrote about bicycling, which might surprise a lot of people. The first time I thought about Beckett on the trip was when it was early on in the trip when I had an experience that in bicycling terms is called bonking, which is when you completely run out of steam and you just can't go any further, or so it seems. And the line from Beckett that ran through my head was, "I can't go on, I can't go on, I must go on, I go on." And Hemingway actually was did some cycling himself, and there was a quotation, I'm actually not sure where it was from, but he said, he was the first one that I ever read who said that bicycling is a way to learn the countryside and the nature of the nature of the place you're in much better than driving in a car.
New York Times writer Bruce Weber's new book is Life is a Wheel from Scribner's.
Our sun will ride on the wheels of a dream.
Quote from the news, "We married for love." That was an unusually cheerful New York Knicks owner James Dolan on signing former Knicks player Phil Jackson as the team's new president. In fact, Jackson is engaged to Jeannie Buss, president of the L.A. Lakers.
Next, lauding Lavin, stage and screen star Linda Lavin, for her singing for Your Ears Only.
Mm-hmm.
A last chorus for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with this quote from the news. I just want to be known for what I do, not who I know. That was fashion designer Loren Scott in a 2008 New York Magazine profile referring to her long-standing romance with rock star Mick Jagger, who was stunned, like so many friends, by her suicide last week at the age of 49. Also known for his friends was former Democratic Party chairman and Washington insider Robert Strauss, who called himself a centrist, a worker, a doer, a putter together. He died last week at age 95. Now this.
There's a new girl in town with a brand new style. She was just passing through, but if things work out, she's gonna stay.
Before TV's Alice, whose theme song she opened with each week, before the last of the Red Hot Lovers, Gypsy, the sisters Rosenzweig, and many more on stage, before film roles with Jeff Bridges, Gerard Depardieu, and, wait for it, the Muppets, Linda Lavin was a singer in night spots around New York and elsewhere. Accordingly, this week, she will add to her collection of Tony, Drama Desk, and Golden Globe Awards a new one for lifetime achievement from her old colleagues in the Manhattan Association of Cabarets and Clubs, the highest of MAC awards. And to talk about that lifetime, past, present, and future, for your ears only, Linda Lavin is on the line now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very, very much. What a lovely introduction. Thank you.
Thank you. Your lengthy Wikipedia entry says you were born in Portland, Maine, to a musical family, first went on stage at age 5, had an actor's equity card even before graduating from the College of William and Mary. Was there ever an instant that you did not see your future as being a performer?
Oh, wow. That's a very good way to put it. I think there wasn't a time when I did not see my future as a... I saw my past, present, and future as a performer. My mother said that I sang before I spoke. Now, I don't know if that's true, but she says I stood straight up in my crib and sang God Bless America before I actually formed full sentences. So it came naturally. My mother was an opera singer who gave up a career that she had been... building in New York in the early 30s. She had a magnificent lyric coloratura voice. It was natural for me to be a singer. It was what we did. We didn't wash a dish without singing three-part harmony, my sister, my mother, and I. So it was something that was part of the DNA and something that has always given me great pleasure.
How did you get into TV? First guest appearances, then the Barney Miller Comedy Cop series.
Well, I went to California from New York and looked for work, just like everybody else. And it was not easy in those days. I left New York in the mid to late 70s, and there was a real strong, thick iron curtain between the two communities, L.A. and New York. So it was not an easy shift to make for any of us. But a lot of New Yorker actors went west at that time. Because everything in New York in the 70s, as you probably know, because your news people, you know, went really sour, everything. The market, real estate, the theater, you name it. It was a tough time. And so we went westward, you know, looking for opportunity. And so did I. And it took me the better part of a year to get a job in television, one of which was a tiny show, a pilot. But in that time, before I got that little role in a pilot, I met with agents and casting directors, and I had some success in New York, in the New York theater. Not that they knew a lot about it out here, because it really was like a different planet. But some people did know, and Danny Arnold was one of them. I met him, and it was one of those meetings that was electrifying for me. He understood me and got me and was very encouraging to me at a time when I was really not finding work out here. I'm in L.A. right now. And that was about 1974. And he said, well, I don't have a part for you yet, but I will. And sure enough, within weeks, he called and he had this fantastic role of the first female detective in The Precinct on Barney Miller. And I knew a lot of New York actors who had moved out here, and I let people know I was here as gratefully as I could, and people opened doors for me. That's what it takes, and you know it takes that outreach, and I was graced with good friends and people who opened doors for me, and as long as it took, I finally became
established. Valerie was on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, so I got into that office, and so I started doing guest jobs on other people's sitcoms. And then after that, that year, at the end of that, actually it was a 10-month period, I got this little part in a pilot at Warner Brothers. And the day that we were shooting the pilot, the head of Warner Brothers TV came to me and said, "We've watched you work all week, and we want to give you a contract. We want to put you under contract for 2 years and build a show around you." And that's how I got the job of Alice. Alice came out of those 2 years.
And what led you back to cabaret singing after so many years? And how does it compare with stage, screen, and TV acting?
Well, you know, for me, performing is performing. It really doesn't matter if it's on one venue or another. It's really connecting with people. It's doing material that you love or that moves you. It's telling your story. It's creating a character. I'm very honored to have this award. I'm surprised and delighted and very honored.
Stage, screen, and TV actress and singer Linda Lavin receives a Lifetime Achievement Award this week from the Manhattan Association of Cabarets and Clubs, fulfilling the lyrics she sang in Gypsy. And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on Air is also online at iTunes, Feedburner.com, and Stitcher.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions with interns Sarah Skirmont and Gene Moon. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the Gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Pledge your tax-deductible donation to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Jean Moon. This week last year, we considered President Obama's renewed initiative to foster Mideast peace. From our March 24, 2013 broadcast, hosted by David and Eddie Robinson.
No wall is high enough and no Iron Dome is strong enough or perfect enough to stop every enemy that is intent on doing so from inflicting harm. The only way for Israel to endure and thrive as a Jewish and democratic state is through the realization of an independent and viable Palestine.
Notwithstanding our joint efforts and your great success in mobilizing the international community, diplomacy and sanctions so far have not stopped Iran's nuclear program. In this regard, Mr. President, I want to thank you once again for always making clear that Israel must be able to defend itself by itself against any threat.
A carefully orchestrated air of good feeling prevailed through most of President Obama's mission to the Holy Land last week. After a little heckling, which reminded Obama of home, he joked, there were cheers from young Israelis, and he encouraged to compromise with Palestinians for a long-touted two-state solution. But the president applied only slight rhetorical pressure against continuing Israeli settlement expansion that works against negotiation. Obama was also consistently vague about just when and how the U.S. would stop the Iranian nuclear program if sanctions and diplomacy don't do the job, which left Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to thank him for letting Israel do the job itself if necessary, presuming that it could.
Following charges that the Assad regime or Syrian rebels had used chemical weapons, Obama also repeated past warnings of a U.S. response if such use is ultimately definitively proved. Ironically, the president's warnings played out on the 10th anniversary of the Bush administration's Iraq attack, which still divides the American people, and of which little official note was taken last week by the White House or Capitol Hill. "This is a little like the crazy uncle in the attic that nobody wants to talk about," said retired Army Lieutenant Colonel John Nagel, now a prominent military analyst. To put Obama, his trip, and Mideast policies in perspective, we're joined again by Michael Brenner, University of Pittsburgh Professor Emeritus and a fellow of the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you.
Did the air of goodwill around Obama last week advance long-stalled peace talks?
No, not at all. In fact, you could argue that it was a negative insofar as it creates the impression that some foundation has been laid for serious diplomatic initiatives when indeed nothing has. In fact, if you look at the main sort of substantive point of agreement, it represented an Obama concession, and it's going to really raise the obstacle to achieving sort of any kind of understanding with the Palestinians, and that is the president has ceased to urge the Israelis to forestall any sort of further development expansion of settlements in the East Bank.
Obama also criticized the Palestinian search for recognition at world bodies like the United Nations and the International Criminal Court, which some experts say is their best alternative to violence while substantive talks with Israel are stalled. What's your view?
Well, I mean, the Palestinians, who have really the party who's been victimized in this, I mean, certainly have a right to take whatever diplomatic steps they deem appropriate to acquire some small amount of leverage. The criticism, I think, is misplaced, but it's simply another indication of the fact that the White House's priority, more than priority, almost exclusive concern is maintaining good relations with Israel. And any conciliation with the Palestinians is subordinate and very sort of subordinate to that goal.
To what degree do you think the bloody legacy of Iraq and the war still winding down in Afghanistan will keep this president from launching preventive action against Iranian nukes or Syrian chemical weapons?
Well, it's an important question, but we're in this odd situation in which Americans collectively, led by the president, have erased the whole Iraq tragedy and fiasco from their memories. So it is certainly not salient and doesn't really cast a sort of heavy shadow at this point. On the other hand, one would presume that there's sort of a recognition that any kind of intervention is far more difficult and purposes have to be far clearer than they were in Iraq. But I don't think there is any prospect of a direct and overt American intervention at this point anywhere in the Middle East. We're not going to be sending any troops. We're not going to be sending, most likely, any aircraft to Syria. Currently, as you know, we refuse to send any arms to the insurgents, even though we've given them our supposedly unqualified political backing in principle. And you know the reasons offered for that. It's our fear that the weapons might wind up in the hands of those elements among the insurgents that we are apprehensive about, particularly the jihadis, al-Nusra is a particular group, and ultimately that they could find their way into the hands of some terrorist organization. But it also means that greatly reduces our influence and our political presence among the insurgents, and when they win, which eventually they will, we don't know when that's going to occur, the timing, they're not going to be very enthusiastic about us.
You also note, besides not arming the insurgents directly, the U.S. is supporting and training Iraqi secret police and anti-terror units that are actually targeting some of these Syrian rebel groups.
Yes. As you know, this is extraordinarily sort of complicated, and you need a three-dimensional hologram to keep track of it. But, I mean, one of the things is clear, and that is we have no comprehensive strategy. We've just sort of treat each of these issues in and of their own terms. We don't make the connection. And so there's a lot of coping going on, but that coping also entails actions that are counterproductive. In other words, It's the defeated elements, or some of the defeated elements of Assam's army, which wanted to escape into Iraq, where they are being killed by Sunni insurgents who identify with the Sunni, fellow religionists across the border. And these same Sunni elements are a threat to the Baghdad Shiite government we support. So we're helping that government, again, to beef up their capabilities in dealing with it. Frankly, I mean, this is what you'd if you excuse my speaking with great candor, this is what you would expect from a bunch of high school kids, playing a diplomatic game on a Saturday afternoon, and not from the United States of America.
What impact do you expect from President Obama playing middleman for an apology from Netanyahu to the Turkish prime minister over a 2010 raid and promise of compensation?
Nothing. I mean, it's a photo op. It's a gesture. It's the kind of thing that'll be played up by the press and talk about how the U.S. can still do these extraordinary things by virtue of its prestige and status. Sure, it's good to have that telephone call, but there are going to be continue to be strains and frictions between Turkey and Israel. And in any event, I mean, the issues regarding Turkey don't have to do with Israel or Palestine. That really not a significant player on that issue.
Michael Brenner is a University of Pittsburgh professor emeritus and a fellow of the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins University.
Obama's Mideast Mission, from our March 24, 2013 broadcast. Last year's pessimism has been borne out. Despite President Obama saying he remained convinced that there is an opportunity, little progress towards peace was evident after his meeting last week with Mahmoud Abbas, leader of the Palestinian Authority. Abbas presented a map showing 10,589 Israeli settlement units built on Palestinian-claimed property in just the last 8 months since peace talks resumed. Abbas also called for release of more Palestinian prisoners under a deal in which he said he agreed not to seek recognition for Palestine by the United Nations and other international bodies. And Abbas rejected Israel's demand that it be recognized as a Jewish state, arguably precluding a right to return for Palestinian refugees who might tip the population Arab. A new book, The Israeli Solution by Caroline Glick, disputes that outcome, claiming Jews could retain a voting majority, even incorporating all Palestinian lands in a single state. An alternative feature called the Glick Plan that is gaining support after repeated failures to agree on a two-state Israel-Palestine solution. I'm Jean Moon. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, Linda Lavin sings You've Got Possibilities, which helped make her a star in the 1966 musical It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman.
Haircut, simply terrible necktie, the worst bearing, just unbearable, what to tackle first. Still, you've got possibilities, though you're horribly square. I see possibilities underneath, there's something there. Collar, pure Peoria, fat hat. Oh no, I'm not Queen Victoria, this suit has to go. Still, you've got possibilities, let us give it a try. I see possibilities, maybe more than meets the eye. Don't back away, come on, unbend. Why can't I be your little friend? Baby, you're improvable. Bite you yet, you'll be shy when I get through. Come on and roll, you tiger, you.
keeping you.